questions because there are some good ones here as usual. And then we'll open it up and you guys can fire away with anything that you want, questions, comments, or whatever. So this is from Linda. Yesterday, President Biden said we are closer to nuclear Armageddon than we have ever been since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Yeah, pretty spooky, right? I mean, these lunatic generals out there are asking for tactical nuclear strikes. I mean, is that a euphemism or what? What's happening over there is just unbelievable. I also heard children in Kyiv going to school in bomb shelters and are terrified of the nuclear attack they expect to come. Yeah, no kidding. And so this is where the questions come in. And I'm going to run commentary and interject some stuff as we go along because the comments, some of the questions are a little bit long. And so I'll read and then run some commentary as we go along. So back from Linda, the world may be illusory, but the suffering is real. Well, we need to understand here, Linda, that when we talk about illusory, it has a very specific meaning here. And if that meaning isn't understood, it's very easy to slip into nihilism and spiritual bypassing. Doesn't matter what happens in Ukraine. Doesn't matter what happens to, you know, my friend's son. It's all an illusion. Oh, good Lord, you can't say that. No, what illusion means here, it simply means that things appear, things have provisional existence for sure. You cannot deny that. This is a really big misunderstanding with teachings on emptiness, dream yoga, illusory form. It's all just a dream. What does it matter what I do? Oh my goodness, that's a pretty big misunderstanding. So illusion means fundamentally, absolutely positively, things do appear. You cannot deny that. Illusion means appearance is not in harmony with reality. And so therefore, when you're dealing with these types of issues, questions, you have to centrifuge out relative and absolute truth. And in fact, until you get into the domain of relative and absolute truth, these issues don't even exist. So the world may be illusory, yes, but you have to define illusion and illusory in a very specific way. Otherwise, it slips into nihilism. But the suffering is real. For sure, the suffering is real. But even them, yes, on a relative level, absolutely positively, suffering is real. But on an absolute level, again, now this is not taking away from all the things we should do on a relative level, and I'll say more about that. On a deep kind of dharmic level, we can actually question the validity, veracity of this thing called suffering itself. How true really is your suffering? On a relative level, absolutely positively. Somebody hits me with a hammer, it hurts like crazy. I'm gonna suffer. But on a pure absolute level, what's really going on beyond that, beneath that? How can you respond to this with an open heart? Well, Linda, I think you partly answered your own question. First thing I would say is, in fact, by responding and not reacting. So the idea that when you respond, if you're responding from an open heart, instead of contracting and reacting from a kind of a dense, contracted head, that responsibility is going to come from this more open space. And from that, you're going to be able, in fact, to be of greater benefit because you're not reacting. You are, in fact, responding. Therefore, you can see more clearly what really needs to be done. You're not projecting the situation with your hopes and fears and imputations. You're actually seeing what's truly going on. And this is why it's very, very helpful to understand both the relative and the absolute vectors so that you can work with both, this really beautiful integral approach. So how can you respond to this with an open heart? Well, you do exactly what you just said. You keep your heart open, as painful as it is, and you respond from that place of vulnerability and compassion. And here there's a whole bunch of things we can say, probably beyond the scope of where we can go, how to avoid burnout, how to do this consistently without really frying yourself out, how to keep giving by understanding deeply that if you relate to things properly, responding instead of reacting, I use this jingle a lot, you feel things more, but they hurt you less because you're not appropriating them. You're not giving them a place to stand. So you feel the heartbreak in Ukraine. You feel the terror of what's going on there. And some of the stuff, did you watch the 60 Minutes thing? last week with the wife of Zelensky. I mean, was that heartbreaking or what? So you listen, you pay attention, you're empathic, but you don't just leave it at the level of empathy, because empathy alone can become a trap. This is why compassion is greater than empathy. Just because you're feeling everything, you become an empath, that does not always initiate action. True compassion initiates action. Empathy can, if it leads to compassion, but empathy in and of itself, not necessarily so. So empathy can become a near enemy here. And there's some studies actually that have shown this. So come back to you. What are the best prayers for a situation like this? Depends on you, Linda. Depends on your background. If you're a Christian, you do the prayers that relate to you there. Again, if you're associated with a particular tradition. Speaking a little bit from the Buddhist perspective, Tong Lim, the thing that we do a lot with Joe and I think to some extent Jeffrey on our Monday night sessions, those of you who attend those, working with the practice of sending and taking. Tong Lim is incredibly powerful. Dedication of merit is incredibly powerful. So there are dozens of different things you can do from the Buddhist perspective to help at this more kind of meditative contemplative level, but always realizing that don't leave it just there. Put your money where your mouth is. Send donations, send supplies, do, you know, these relative, but completely effective and also very, very beneficial, very helpful activities to help the world, right? So what are the best prayers for a situation like this? Depends on you and your background. I was a teenager during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I remember that as well, and I was scared. I'm not scared for myself now, but I worry where this will lead the world and how much suffering will follow. I'm with you, man. I am really worried about this as well. In fact, honestly, if we're not just totally freaked out by what's happening in the world today, right? I mean, we could list the endless growing list of atrocities, injustices, and everything. It's just unbelievable. We are in the dark age. If we're not feeling this, and we're not a little bit afraid or a lot afraid, we don't know what's going on. It is bad. But here's the deal. It's said in the tradition, and I think it's really, really quite true, that the bodhisattvas, they actually go into the lower realms. They go into the hell realms. They voluntarily make aspirations and intentions to be reborn in times like this, in situations like this, where they're needed the most. And so therefore, that's another way to look at it, is look at it through the eyes of a bodhisattva who takes voluntary rebirth at a literal level into the lowest hell realms and whatnot, because that's where the most help is needed. And so what we can do with our openness, with our receptivity, armed with all the teachings that help us to engage in this without being burned out, with all the skillful means on a relative and absolute level that can help, then we're actually somewhat specifically situated, uniquely qualified to help at both relative and absolute levels. And so through the level of meditation, realizing that we have impact on the world through what we do with our thoughts and our prayers, that has an effect. What we do with our speech, what we do with our actions definitely does help. And so we can look at this absolutely positively as an atrocity, because it is. We can look at it as an obstacle, but we can also look at it as an opportunity to provide service, to provide giving, and basically just never give up. Look at the Dalai Lama. His entire country destroyed, basically. Thousands of monasteries just razed to the ground. 1 million people are eradicated. The civilization virtually destroyed. And he just gets up day after day after day, endlessly, endlessly, endlessly living and breathing for the service of others. Is it easy? No, it's not easy. But this is just what bodhisattvas do. So this is a really great question. I like it, Linda, because it's really, really practical and applicable. And those of you who know when I'm chatting these days, almost at the end of every program, I say is, if what we're doing is not of a practicality, if what we're doing with these teachings isn't of benefit to the world today, it's irrelevant. It doesn't matter. What matters is taking what we're doing here and getting in the streets, getting whatever we need to do, voting, doing all the things. You know, it's like Suzuki Roshi said beautifully, strictly speaking, there are no enlightened beings. There's only enlightened activity. So this is really important to me, that if we're just engaging in this stuff as spiritual armchairing, philosophical armchairing, we're totally missing the mark. The whole idea here is to take these teachings, use them to empower your wisdom, compassion, and the efficiency, the efficacy of what you do, and then get out there and do something. So this is a really great contribution. Great question, Linda. Not a difficult, easy one, a difficult question, but it points to some really important ideas. Okay, from Katie. Katie always has great questions for us. We suffer because we imagine that reality has qualities that it doesn't, permanence, solidity, etc. Yes, so this is again a longer one, so I'll run commentary and respond as we go through it. Yes, this is what's called the imaginary nature. That what we do here, Katie, is exactly what you're saying. We suffer because we impute, we project onto reality qualities that is not inherently there. This is this kind of other powering, it's called Shenwang, where you literally imbue reality with power it doesn't inherently have through the process of projection. You take the qualities of your own structures of consciousness, and unbeknownst to us, because structures of consciousness, you don't look at them, you look through them. We project these qualities onto the world. We reify, freeze, create a world in our own image. Back to you. In Tibetan Buddhism, we use imagination. Not just Tibetan Buddhism. Carl Jung used it, active imagination, all the contemplative traditions I'm aware of use it. We use imagination as skillful means, paren, through visualization of deities, channels, etc., to alleviate suffering. That's true. It works. Yes, it does. But how does replacing, here's a question, but how does replacing one imagination with another lead to a clear perception and realization? This is a good question. I love it. It's so big, in fact, Katie, that as you may know, in the tantric traditions, some scholars, especially I can speak a little bit more authoritatively about Tibetan Tantra Buddhism. I've heard some scholars say that of all tantric practice, one third, it's difficult to make these rough generalizations, but it's also a little bit kind of orienting. One third of Tantra is actually about this issue. In our languaging, it's also called pure illusory form practice. And I'll be saying a little bit more about that. It's also known as generation stage practice. It's also known as deity yoga. It's also known as yidam practice. These are all basically synonyms for the same colossal set of practices that I do these every single day. And I've done these literally for years, decades at this point. And because I've been doing this for so many countless hours for so many years, I've looked into this very, very deeply, because I want to know what I'm doing and why. So I've spent a lot of time with this one, Katie. So the reason it works in the briefest bullet point way for a topic that is really big is that we're using imagination in a way to fight fire with fire. We're using imagination that is in harmony, a process that is actually in harmony with reality. So when you're engaged with these practices, so some people may not know what you're doing here. When you're working with these visualization, imagination practices, all the names I gave for it, you visualize yourself as a deity. That's the first thing you do. Well, why do you do that? Let's just start right there. Well, you're doing it for a number of reasons. One is working with your mind, visualizing yourself, imagining yourself as a deity is one way to work with what's called tantric shamatha. So you're working to stabilize your mind through the process of visualization itself. That's one thing you're doing. The second thing you're doing is a process of, this is my language, and you won't find this. I don't even think it's a word, but you get the idea. Almost everything we do with our unwitting visualization, imagination practices. So this is the other really amazing thing about these practices. What they do, these meditations, is they take a process that's already taking place, like you're saying here, this process of projection and imagination, and it transforms it in an alchemical tantric way. It transforms samsara into nirvana through these methodologies. So it takes something that we're doing, whether we know it or not. We're always imagining things. We're always projecting. We're always involved in a kind of samsaric generation stage practice, all in the service of reductionism. We don't even know we're doing it. Degrading ourselves and others by seeing ourselves in these ridiculous ways. And so by visualizing yourself as a deity, and there's so much else besides what I'm about to say, one of the things you're doing is you're actually practicing a form of elevationism. You're actually seeing yourself again in a form that is more in resonance with the way things really are. So Imagination also works at the level of the Sambhogakaya. So again, I can't define all these terms, but Katie knows these terms. Working with sound, mantra visualization in these practices lifts you up out of this frequency domain into the domain of sound and light, which is actually closer to reality, is closer to the truth. So these practices serve to lift you up. So you visualize yourself as a deity. You visualize the world as a mandala, as a sacred environment, because in essence, that's what it is. If you see the world properly, it actually reveals itself as a mandala. Now, it's not going to reveal itself in the ways that you see when you're working with mandalas and you're working to visualize a palace. These are all archetypes. Even the deity seeing yourself, that's an archetype. So it's not like you're going to run around and see everybody like a cartoon character that you see in these religious scrolls. Not at all. One of my teachers said, you know, cartoon visualization brings about cartoon realization. No, you have to understand the basis of what you're doing here. And so by doing this, you're cleaning up yourself and the world. It's actually a type of Pure Land practice. It's a type of inner tantric Pure Land practice where you're faking it, of course, because you don't see yourself as a deity. You don't see everybody else as a deity. You don't see this world as a sacred mandala. You don't see it as a Pure Land. But that's only because you're a victim of all your unconscious negative visualization practices. And so this is an amazingly powerful, effective set of meditations that, again, your question's great, because the more you understand it, the more you're going to do it, the more it makes sense. And then you realize the absolute genius of these types of practices. They're unbelievably powerful. And so what else? I wrote a couple of notes down here. Yeah, so the other thing that this does, and this is also a really big part of these imagination practices, visualization practices, they're designed in a, again, this is all slightly esoteric. So they're designed to purify birth. And by that, what I mean is that the mind, the formless mind, is always taking birth. The formless mind is always forming itself spontaneously, driven out of habit, karma, impulse, into these samsaric images that we know as thought forms, degraded image, you know, narratives, all the things. The mind is constantly giving birth. Just sit in meditation for 30 seconds to see how your mind is always birthing out of formless awareness all the images of your mind. And then by extension, fundamentally, really the reified so-called objects of the external world. And so these practices purify birth because they allow you to shape your mind voluntarily. Instead of letting your mind just run away in involuntary overpopulation, it's really a population problem, taking these samsaric forms, thought forms involuntarily, you're giving birth to formless awareness intentionally. And then therefore, in the Bardo teachings, this practice is another massive dimension of these practices. This practice then eventually purifies literal reincarnation. It literally purifies your next life. Because just like now you're giving birth to thought involuntarily, that involuntary rebirth process will lead you into an involuntary rebirth life after life after life forever until you do something like this, where then what you do through these practices and others, then you shape your mind, you form it intentionally, not out of ignorance, confusion, habit, impulse, but out of love, kindness, compassion. Those are called the voluntary incarnates. So this is a really great big question, Katie, and I'll leave it there for now, but boy, you're barking up the right tree if you want to engage in these practices and really explore them. Again, I do these every single day of my life. They're in the world of dream yoga, illusory form. This is what's called pure illusory form practice of the three types, impure, pure, and perfectly pure. This is pure. To tie it into what I said at the outset, the way it matures into seeing the world in a sacred and perfectly pure way is eventually you start to see yourself as a deity. That doesn't mean you're going to wake up, look in the mirror, and you're going to look like Chakrasamvara or somebody. No. It means the archetype of Chakrasamvara or Vajrayogini or any of the hundreds of archetypes represented in these deities is actualized. You actually see yourself this way. You see the world in that way spontaneously. That's called perfectly pure illusory form, where the world is then seen in this way. So, Katie, this is a really big, great question. I'm going to let it go for now just because we could talk about this for weeks. Okay. From Jason. Hello, Andrew. I was ordained a Taoist monk some 30 years ago. Very cool. Good for you, man. However, dream yoga is something new to me. It is for many. I'm struggling with the idea of repeating this is a dream and doing reality checks at the same time. Okay, let's help you. It seems that by doing a state check, I'm confirming that I may not be in a dream, which negates assuming that I am in a dream. Okay, so right here, we need to clarify a couple things, because what you're doing when you're conducting the state check here, Jason, and if you're here, we can talk about this back and forth directly. This question actually centrifuges out the difference between lucid dreaming and dream yoga. And so I riff on this a little bit because there's a lot of confusion around this, and it is confusing. That when you're doing a state check, what a state check is, for those of you who may not be familiar with it, state checks are classic lucid dreaming techniques where basically you train yourself, you sensitize yourself to develop what's called a critically reflective attitude towards the arising of your experience. And so how this relates to the dream, and then you'll see how it relates to dream yoga in this so-called waking state, is that one of the reasons, main reason where we remain non-lucid to our dreams at night is because we take at face value whatever appears. Pink elephant appears, you don't question it. You're flying in the dream, you don't question it. So this non-reflective attitude is what in fact keeps us sucked into non-lucidity. And so by working with state checks that are also connected with dream signs, and I'll come back to that in a second, you can actually run a test, either by jumping up and down or trying to put your finger through your palm or any of the dozens of different things that we've talked about in so many different settings. You train yourself to do this in a dream. And then by realizing that, hey, I'm jumping up in a dream, I'm keeping going. I'm flying up. That's a state check that confirms that, hey, I can't do this in waking or reality. I'm either dreaming or dead. You're either in a dream or you're in the bardo. That moment of critically reflective attitude, that state check will confirm that you're in a nighttime dream and you're instantly lucid. Now, how that works in the waking state, this is where dream yoga centrifuges out from lucid dreaming. Because when you do a dream, when you do a state check in the world of lucid dreaming, like right now, you do a state check, let's all jump up, we jump up, we come back down. Okay, great. I've just confirmed I'm awake here. That's terrific. Yes, you are awake in a provisional sense in relationship to the example dream, to the double delusion of the nighttime dream. You see what I'm saying here? So you conduct a state check to confirm that you're awake from the nighttime dream into this seeming waking reality. But here's where it gets slippery. Because in the world of dream yoga, the very criteria that you use to assess that you're dreaming, that you're awake in the world of lucid dreaming is exactly the same criteria that you now use to assess that you're asleep in the world of dream yoga. You see the difference? In other words, if you jump up and you come down, you see the world as solid, lasting, and independent. That actually means, that's a dream sign that means you're asleep in the world of samsara. You're awake in relation to the nighttime double delusion, but you're still asleep in this reality. And that's the difference. And that's how you centrifuge those two things out. And so what I'm seeing here, Jason, is a confusion, conflation of lucid dreaming and dream yoga and how dream signs, state checks are worked with in both those domains. Same words, different kind of application. Okay. All right. Said another way, this is back to him. Reality checks interrupt the state of being of believing you are in a dream. That's true. If I believe I am in a dream, why should I check to see if I was or not? And this is so important because just believing in it and just thinking in it is not enough. You can think that you're awake and you're still dreaming. Let me say that again. Just believing or thinking that you're awake is not enough. You can say to yourself right now, oh my gosh, I think I'm awake. Maybe in relation to the nocturnal dream, the double delusion, but just by thinking you're awake now doesn't mean you're awake now. That's why you have to conduct these state checks. You see, just by thinking or believing it, it's not enough. It's just like a hypothesis. You have to test it. It's not enough. And actually, the dream researchers will tell you this absolutely positively. You have to test it. Otherwise, you're just kidding yourself. Okay? All right, a couple more from Marlies. These are so fun. Okay, for some time I'm pondering if conscious habits / karma create non-lucid dreams. Yes, and in lucid dreams, our actions and intentions create karma, like in our physical reality. Yes, that's true, but only if we're lucid. If you're non-lucid, it doesn't create karma. It's the production and the effect of karma, but you're not producing karma. You only produce karma if intentionality is there, just like you said. Back to Marlies, what if time doesn't really exist, Carlo Rovelli? Yeah, it's not just Carlo who says this, a theoretical physicist. Fundamentally, any sensitive scientist, physicist, I should say, going back to Einstein and even before, will tell you that time doesn't exist. It's not just time that doesn't exist. Space doesn't exist. Causality doesn't exist in the realm of absolute truth. In fact, one way to determine, again, kind of like a dream sign, state check, one way to determine that you're still in relative reality, you're still in samsara, is if there's temporal, spatial, and causal dimensions still at play. Let me say that again. One way to determine that you're not fully awake, that you're still in the realm of samsara, that you're still in the realm of relative truth, is if you experience space-time, which we all do. It's like the background, the axiomatic background of our experience. No, it's not. It's a construct. If you see this world temporally, spatially, and causally, that's a fundamental dream sign that you're actually asleep. So it's not just Carlo Rovelli. It's Nima Arcani Hamed, great physicist. You can hear this wonderful talk, Space-Time is Doomed. You can pull it up online. Any sensitive physicist will tell you space and time don't exist. Back to you. Relative levels, again, centrifuge, relative, and absolute truth. At relative levels, absolutely space exists, time exists, causality exists. Otherwise, science wouldn't work. Technology wouldn't work. That is relative truth. You can't deny it. It absolutely positively has provisional relative validity reality. And that's why things, so to speak, work at that level. So if time doesn't really exist and the world doesn't really exist, this is where you got to be careful again. The world, who said the world doesn't really exist? You name a guy here, Marcus Gabriel. I don't know his work. I would like to see what does he mean when the world doesn't exist? Is he talking about this centrifuging out of relative and absolute truth? So I can't speak to what he proclaims there, but I would be extremely cautious, just like with the first question. In fact, I would say you can't do this. You just can't do it because it's wrong. The world doesn't exist. Yes, it does. Step out in front of that bus coming out the street and see if the world is illusory when it smacks you and you're dead. So you can't say the world doesn't exist. It doesn't exist in the way that we impute it to exist. If that's what this guy is saying, high five. But if it's this kind of nihilistic, potentially bypass thing, woo, you can't say that. Okay, back to Marlies. What if karma creates space and time? Yes, karma is part of the generative impulse of that. What else do you think constructs our illusions? I laugh because it's such a great question. Well, fundamentally, Marlies, what constructs our illusions is ignorance. Ignorance, marigpa, not knowing, the first nadana, the primary spark plug in the wheel of life. Ignorance is the principal construct of space, time, causality, the projection of the so-called real world. So again, if this Marcus character, Marcus Gabriel is saying the world doesn't exist as a projection of ignorance, that's spot on. But if he's saying what most people say around it, I wouldn't agree with that at all. So basically what constructs our illusions is ignorance that then is thrown into form through the projective powers of the mind generated by fear, bad habits, karma, and impulse. And so all the wisdom traditions, and again, I can speak a little bit more about Buddhism, depending on which school you're talking about, literally every school has their answer to this question. So if you talk about it from an Abhidhamma point of view, they would say it's the five skandhas that created. If you talk about it from a Mahayana point of view, it would again be marigpa, the inability to understand the nature of emptiness. If you talk about it from a tantric point of view, it would be what constructs the illusion is reified light. So it really depends, Marlies. This is, again, these are beautiful big questions. What constructs our illusions? Basically, these fundamental things I mentioned, but then each and every single school in Buddhism, of which there are many, has its own respective answer. So this is a really big question. Good one. Okay, so let's see. There was one from Tim here. Yeah, I really feel an attraction to calling to dream yoga. Cool. I know you said that to be successful at dream yoga, we need to be able to do lucid dreaming. Yep, because dream yoga transcends but includes lucid dreaming. No dreams, no lucid dreaming. No lucid dreaming, no dream yoga. Back to him, from what I have learned so far, I'm trying to work with these factors to induce dreams. Intention, journaling, meditation, daily reality testing, occasional use of galantamine, books, videos, workshops, saturate my mind. Is that pretty much it? Or am I missing anything else you can think of? That's pretty much it. Do you want more? This is, if you do this with consistency, with constancy, with patience, with perseverance, everything you just said here, Tim, and this is a wonderful summation of the principal ingredients, you're going to start having these lucid dreams. Am I missing anything or can you do more? Yes, you can do more. But this is where, you know, you have to make this, you talked about this as dream yoga being my spiritual path. Well, if it's really your spiritual path, and again, fantastic if it is, the next step for you would be to do the six yogas of Naropa, the six dharmas of Naropa. This is where dream yoga is principally taught. This is the way I learned it. But for that, you need, oh my gosh, a little bit of preparation, to put it mildly. You need to do these loop things. You have to jump through these hoops to get these teachings. But if for the people that are super serious, that really want to go with the stuff as deep as you possibly can, the six dharmas are the way to go. That's the way I learned them. Because then you have a whole set of practices before you even get to dream yoga. The inner yogas, the inner heat yogas, the Chandali Tummo, lucid form practice, all these things that massively grease the skids so that when you actually get to dream yoga, it becomes much more available to you. So everything you're doing here from a causal vehicle point of view, Tim, is high five, spot on. You nailed it. Great summary. If you want to go one step and really get to the guts of it, the next step, which would make it a true spiritual path for you that would take years, I highly recommend it. Do the six yogas. And you have to find a teacher. There aren't that many that do it, but they're still out there who actually does these trainings. Takes a fair amount of prep. But if you really want to do this stuff, that's where you go. Okay, so there's another one I got here. Hold on. Okay, so from Isaac, and I hope Isaac is here, because I did not understand your question, my friend, so I apologize. Do you have experience with quote-unquote dreaming and quote-unquote dreamless sleep in meditation? Not in dream yoga, but in actual sitting meditation. I would need to ask you some questions, Isaac. I'm addressing this because I want to pay homage to that you sent me this question, but I don't know what you mean here. So when you say dreaming, do you mean like I'm sitting in meditation and I literally start to dream? What do you actually mean? When you say dreamless sleep in meditation, do you mean that I'm in meditation and I fall into a formless dimension? If that's the case, then for sure. So I can't really address this without some clarification on your part, because I just don't know what you're referring to when you say dreaming and dreamless sleep in meditation. That you're speaking of something that doesn't resonate with me in terms of reference and signify. So if you're there, come on board and let me know. Last one, and then we'll open it up. Yeah, this question is so good. From Susan. Seeing emptiness directly. Okay, these are nice, wonderful, deep questions. Seeing emptiness directly, the first bhumi, is a shift in consciousness. Yes, you could totally say that. The first bhumi is also the first ground. So, boy, there's so much to say here, right? First bhumi is the first of 10 bhumis, 10 grounds, leading from basic introduction to the nature of reality, which is what emptiness is, all the way to the full actualization, stabilization of it, the 10th bhumi, and then 11th bhumi, which is Buddhahood. So it's also called the third path of five paths in Buddhism. It's called the path of seeing. It's really where you want to get in this life before you die. This is a dimension of experience you want to try to reach before you die, because it's utterly non-retrogressive. Once you attain a glimpse of the first bhumi, the path of seeing, you're never going to fall back again. You'll never be fooled again. But I would be a little bit more refined here, Susan. I would say it's not a shift in consciousness. It's the end of consciousness. Because consciousness, remember, this may seem like, he's just word playing. No. This is important. This is where Buddhism separates itself from the Hindu traditions, especially Advaita Vedanta, where they talk about pristine consciousness, pure consciousness, in their languaging. Pure consciousness is an oxymoron in Buddhism, because consciousness by definition is always dualistic in the Buddhist world. They make a very big difference, an important one, between consciousness and wisdom. Consciousness is dualistic, wisdom awareness is non-dualistic. So consciousness by definition actually can't experience the first bhumi. They're mutually exclusive. So that's the first thing I would say, that it's not just a shift in consciousness, it's the end of consciousness. That's why if you're unprepared, you go unconscious, like we do in deep dreamless sleep. You can get a glimpse of the first bhumi every single night when you fall into deep dreamless sleep. But unless you're aware of it, lucid to it, you don't experience wisdom. You literally go unconscious. So it's not just a shift of consciousness. It's when consciousness transforms into wisdom, when duality transforms into non-duality. So back to you. Seeing emptiness directly, the first bhumi is a shift in consciousness, direct recognition that all appearances are mind. Yes, it's true. But it's not just that. It's not just saying that all appearances are mind. It's also an immediate discovery, Susan, that mind is empty, that emptiness is spontaneously present, that spontaneous presence is self-liberated, right? So this is another, this is such a rich question. So yes, it is a recognition that all appearances are mind for sure. But then it's like, okay, well, what is this mind? What is it? What is that exactly? What is it made? What is that made of? So it's part of what you're saying is true. But again, if you're using mind, there's a difference here. Usually when the Buddhists talk about mind, they use the word sem. Sem is associated with consciousness. That's confused mind. What you want to do is transform mind, sem, into wisdom, rigpa. That's a transformation of consciousness into wisdom or awareness. So this is another really great question. Do the short instances of recognition of the nature of mind during pointing out instructions, directions, and self-inquiries during meditation eventually lead to this shift? Yeah, for sure. That's what they're there for. And so they are glimpses of this eyesight, glimpses of this vision. And so the pointing out transmissions, those of you who may not be aware of this is when a teacher, somewhat akin to the Shaktipat tradition in Hinduism, this is when a teacher, through various magical approaches and whatnot, will actually point out emptiness, will point out the nature of reality. That's what's called pointing out. I like to talk about it as pointing in transmission, where you get a glimpse, you get a peek. Oh, that's it. What's very funny, in an interesting way, I've been blessed to have dozens and dozens of these by masters all around the world for decades. And very often when people have these things, it's kind of humorous because it's such a fleeting glimpse. Very often people come out and they whisper to each other, did you get it? Did you get it? It's actually quite funny in a certain way. And one way is very interesting. This ties into the earlier question about illusory form. One way to actually assess that you got it or not is that after you have a pointing out transmission and you get it, the world appears like what? A dream. It's beautiful. One way to assess that you got it is you look up and what you're seeing is like a dream. So that's one way to assess it. The analytic meditations that you talk about, the self-inquiries, in a certain way, those are more powerful. Because what they do, and again, this is like the whole path of Ramana Maharshi, answering the question, who am I? These paths of self-inquiry, analytic meditation, Vipassana, these are in a certain way more important. This is why I teach so much now in open awareness meditation, because what these practices do, Susan, is the analytic meditations more important, I think, than the pointing out transmissions, is the analytic meditations provide breadcrumbs. In other words, by engaging in the analytic meditations, you can work your way back, like Hansel and Gretel leaving breadcrumbs to find their way home. The analytic meditations leave breadcrumbs. So you engage in them over and over and over, the Maha Mudra investigations, all the practices that you may or may not be aware of, they allow you to work your way back through analytic meditation, Vipassana, on your own. And that's why it's such a big deal, right? Okay, so let me just rephrase this again. Do the short instances of recognition during pointing out transmissions and self-inquiry eventually lead to the shift? Yes, they do. Or is it a big shift that happens all at once? Hardly ever. I mean, basically, I would say never, with some qualifications. And the reason I say this is because there are people running around today, and if this wasn't being recorded, I would give you their name so you stay away from them, who have a glimpse of this, legitimate. I'm not criticizing the glimpse, whatever. State realization, not trait stabilization. There's a difference between states and traits, or experience and realization. Lots of people in the West have these dramatic insights, and they're only dramatic in terms of contrast. That's what makes them dramatic. If you're super contracted, the contrast is ecstatic. It's just like this cosmic orgasm. You feel like you've attained enlightenment. No, you haven't. You've just glimpsed it. And the only reason it's dramatic is because you're so contracted before you have it. But then these people, because they don't understand the difference between states and traits, they and their disciples become state junkies. They really get lost. And you get this whole really damaging, endangering cult thing that happens all the time. Just because somebody had a beautiful, legitimate experience and not a stable realization. So the reason I say this is it's unbelievably rare to have, you know, like a King Indrabhuti experience in history where some person who's so ripe, you know, something happens, or Marpa, you know, Marpa gets slapped in the face, or whoever got, I can't remember, it was Kalopa, gets slapped in the face, the sandal, the flip-flop hits him in the face, he's irreducibly enlightened. That basically never happens. And if you think it is, you're probably kidding yourself. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying it's virtually impossible. These are the path is really one of the gradual path to sudden enlightenment. Yes, some people can be so ripe that when they get one of these transmissions or Talopa slaps them with a flip-flop, they wake up. Yes, theoretically, it can happen. In fact, it can happen right now. But practically, it doesn't. Why? Because of the power of habit, karma, relative truth is still there. This massive tsunami of karma is still there to slam the clouds back in once the lightning strike is over, and you're still back in this confused dimension. So this is why you have to be really, really careful with these sorts of things. So does it happen all at once? Yet, basically, yet. Theoretically, yes, but practically, no. Does this shift happen for many students, or is it rare? I can't say. I mean, the people who really have realization are the most humble. They're the ones that don't talk about it. They're the ones that just do their bodhisattva activity and remain completely anonymous and help others and then just die completely anonymously. So how many does this happen to? I don't really know. Do people have glimpses and attain a glimpse of the first bhumi? For sure. Happens all the time. And in fact, I'll stop here because, oh my gosh, we're already at the hour mark and I haven't even opened it up. This is where you have to differentiate between what's called access and phenomenal consciousness. From a philosophical point of view, you can totally have an experience of this. And in fact, you have it every night. You just don't recognize it when you fall into deep dreamless sleep. So you have phenomenal experience of it, but you don't have access to it. In other words, you don't recall it. So these are beautiful questions. I love them. Really rich, wonderful. Thank you so much for sending them. Sorry they took so long, but I want to answer them with some rigor. I don't want to just soundbite these. Each one of these questions you could do a whole week on. But anyway, if there are some live questions, we can now entertain those. Thanks for your patience.
Let me get you muted, Quilly. And there's some that came through.
Hi, Quilly. Oh my gosh, so nice to see you.
Be here, Andrew.
Oh my gosh. big hugs.
I miss your enthusiasm, and I've been listening to some unusual podcasts, and you know, it's astonishing to me, but put your enthusiasm together with your depth of knowledge, and you meet those people. Like, I know it thrills them to be interviewed by you.
It's that, well, hold on, Quilly, something's ringing.
Oh. I hear it. It's on my phone too. I'm sorry. I can't stop it, but it does stop. How like do I?
Like a dream sign.
I think it was something that she had going.
Let us, Quilly, let us know when it stops and then come back on, because we literally can't hear you, okay? When it stops, wave to us and then we'll bring you back on, because it's so loud. Did it stop?
Not yet.
Yeah. Let us know when it stops and then raise your hand. We'll bring you back on, okay? We literally can't hear you, but so stay tuned, okay? Hey, Anisha.
Hi, Andrew.
Nice to see you.
Hi. Yes, it's been a while. Thank you.
How can I help you today?
Yes, a quick question. So I have a dream practice question.
Cool.
And the question is, you know, who are we talking to when we address the dreaming mind in a lucid dream in particular? You know, it's been one of my, you know, for example, when I get lucid, I have, you know, I talk to my dreaming mind and say, you know, improve clarity or improve, bring me some stability, lucidity, and it happens. It does change, or give me light, or, you know. And so I just wondered, you know, for example, one of the things I've been really desiring is to manifest a dream guide to kind of help me navigate the dream world.
Yeah,
because I feel like I have a hard time getting lucid. I might get lucid like once a month, every other month.
Yeah.
And there's so many dream signs all over, but I just don't get lucid, you know, because I'm not practicing as much. And so I've been really, you know, trying to bring my daytime practice into kind of the nighttime arena, you know, with, so one of my, you know, questions is more kind of like, you know, how can we use dream yoga as a path to develop trust and connect with kind of Buddha nature? I did that once. I asked the dreaming mind, you know, show me my Buddha nature.
Yeah.
So if you could say a little bit about that, like, you know, like how the dreaming mind seems sometimes, it's, yeah, the dream is sort of a reflection of our expectations and thoughts. And, you know, I can see that as it happens, you know,
right.
It'll morph according to, literally it'll morph. I can see that. But then there's also something beyond that that still manifests, you know, that's not my thinking mind.
Right. Yeah,
such a great question. Right. If you could say a little bit in a way that would inspire me, I don't know.
Yeah, I can try. Basically, this goal, you know, dream goal. That's a great question.
Thank you.
So, you're very welcome. So what this immediately begets is the issue of mind itself, right? And again, another one of these tiny little issues, like what is mind? How does it manifest? This is so important with these practices, not merely in terms of addressing your question, but these are really, really big, big issues. And so first thing to understand perhaps is, the deeper under dimensions, the deeper kind of spectrum of mind on different axes, you could say. So on one level, it's important to understand, and this is, I think, quite helpful, that it's not mind, it's minds. So we use a catch-all phrase to denote this thing called mind, but to really take it apart is very worthwhile endeavor, and it will answer all your questions. So one thing is to understand that it's not mind in a reified monolithic sense. It's actually minds, plural. Every moment there's a new mind that's appearing in an atomistic way. Out of the zero point energy field, using physical terms, or the Dharmakaya or Turiya, a moment of awareness, a dharma, a moment of experience, atoms of experience, arises, and a new mind arises with that, moment to moment to moment to moment, like a pixelated painting. And it's only the speed of the untamed, untrained mind that creates what's called, through flicker fusion, that creates the illusion of a continuity of mind. And then almost by immediate implication, a self-appropriator who is actually having that mind slash ego. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, when you have these experiences, and it's a beautiful question, when you're really doing deeper work like this, and you're making a kind of supplication, you're actually opening, two things can be happening. And I leave this to you to play with. One is, you could actually be relating, supplicating, asking for guidance for your deeper self. And so Jung did this. Like Jung had his dream guide, Philemon, right? I mean, he was like a lifetime companion for Carl Jung. Read about him. It's amazing how much he relied on him and how much Philemon would guide him and help him and teach him. So having a dream guide is a really beautiful thing to do. And if you're cultivating that, just keep going. Now, where is that dream guide coming from? That's difficult to say. Is it in fact an archetypal representation of the deeper dimensions of your own wisdom mind coming forth in that image so that you can establish a relationship to that particular appearance? Or is it in fact something coming outside of your whirlpool, outside of your own kind of self-sense, where, you know, transcendent forces are actually impinging upon you and delivering insights from outside? Maybe on an absolute level, they're the same. I think I leave this as an open question for you. But when it's a little bit like asking when you're doing supplications, you know, grant your blessings so that my mind may be one with the Dharma. Well, who's the you-er? Who's the you-er? Who's granting the blessing? So these are wonderfully powerful questions that lead to great insight. And I like to be somewhat agnostic about these because that allows you to actually work with this as part of your own path. And maybe incubate a journey, incubate a dream that will allow you to discover the answer for yourself, because then it's going to deliver a lot more impact than what I can give to you, right? But to me, these are both completely viable ways, not necessarily mutually exclusive, that these energetics, these agencies, and this is what I'm going to be talking a lot about with Sean Esbjorn Hargens in a couple of weeks, this idea of the ontology matrix and non-human intelligences. He's a real, really bright guy about this sort of thing. What are these NHIs? Where do they come from? How real are they? How can they affect us? How can they help us? So I would perhaps work with just, you know, explore the different dimensions of mind using different traditions. Obviously, I'm a little bit biased and in favor of the Buddhist approach because they have wonderfully sophisticated ways where you can understand gain a deeper understanding of the dimension of your own being, and then really start to answer these questions from your own side. But I'll pause for a second to see if that's helpful and if you want to take it anyplace else.
I was kind of, you know, yeah, I would agree with you. I mean, I think it's more of an experiential question, you know, in meditation to experience blessings or whom are we supplicating to is more of an inner journey. I think I've connected with that in the waking state, sort of, as a way of opening to, you know, just opening.
Exactly. It takes place when you become more transparent, translucent to yourself. You make yourself more available to these agencies. And so whether they're coming from within, from without, does it really matter? On one level, it doesn't. But you'll find, in fact, a natural consequence of this type of porosity of mind is, in fact, the ability to gain this type of insight. And in the Buddhist tradition, somewhat connected to the earlier practice, a question about generation deity yoga practices, not only are they archetypes internally, but they are as real or as unreal as we are. And so therefore, you can effectively ask Amitabha to come into your dreams to help. You can ask Vajrayogini or somebody else to come in and work with you in that regard. And so this is where it could be of some benefit for you if you are interested to develop a relationship during the day with the Yidam, with the deity, so that you can then employ that, so to speak, in the service of your own wisdom. And then they will come to help you and guide you. So I would actually encourage that if it speaks to you from whatever tradition, you absolutely positively can evoke these agencies, these non-human super intelligences, to infuse you, help you, guide you, and bless you. So, I mean, that's what I would do.
Yeah, you know, it's. I feel like in the dream space, there's just so much possibility for me personally. It's just so much more fluid, and it's just easier for me to do things than in the waking. You know, okay. Because things are so real in the waking. It's hard to
seem real.
For me at least, you know. But in the dream space, it just feels more open. You know. I'm more open, I think, in a lucid dream. And so I feel like this actually informs my daytime practice. I was looking the other way around, sort of to use the dream arena as a way to develop trust you know, mostly is to develop trust in that kind of, I don't know, that there is that kind of, I mean, by saying words like benevolence and stuff like that, you know, we start to anthropomorphize or whatever. I mean, we tend to kind of project that aspect to things, but that's all I know, you know, I don't know anything beyond that.
Right.
So it was more kind of the other way around, sort of. Yeah, I think I resonate with what you say about, you know, dream yoga as a path. It just seems like it's easier to see through things in the dream state than in the real world.
You know, Mijo Rinpoche says that point blank. Tsongkhya mm-hmm. Rinpoche says it point blank. You know, it's an easier classroom to study the nature of reality, to study emptiness. And that's why for you, that's why I'm so passionate about this stuff, because it actually is an easier classroom for doing this sort of thing. So I just really encourage you to do it. And again, what you're doing when you're engaging in this stuff is you're opening up an interstate traffic, interstate commerce between these previously disparate states of consciousness. And so you start to cross-pollinate, your waking state starts to help infuse lucidity in the dream state. The insights from the dream state then ping back. This is a big difference between lucid dreaming and dream yoga. Those insights then come back in a bi-directional way to inform, transform your waking state. And so you have this virtuous feedback loop that then bootstraps each other, where you're working and taking advantage of these amazing states of consciousness and the preciousness that we have, you know, of the time on this planet. So I couldn't agree more with you with your approach and what you're doing. Okay.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew.
Welcome. So I'm going to get one here. I'll come back to Quilly in a second if she's still good. Let me get one that came in here from Premdas. Andrew, since Yidam Sadhners are 1/3 of Tantra, what are the other 2/3? Yes. The other 2/3 would be the inner yogas. And then the other 1/3 would be the formless meditation. So you have deity yoga, generation stage practice. Or you could say if your generation stage practice is 1/3, completion stage practice is 1/3. That's also formless meditation. The inner yogas are 1/3. Okay. Okay, Tim, I'm going to come back to you for a second because I already answered one for you. Barry, anyone interested in the six yogas of Naropa may check out the following online training. Naropa Vajrayogini and six yogas of Naguma. Yeah, that's Naropa's sister with Glenn Mullen. He's a character. Yeah, thanks, Barry. Glenn is a real pistol. He's great. He's really great. Okay. All right. So Quilly, are you good now? Can you come back on? All right. Unmute yourself, dear.
Yeah, sorry.
There you go. Now we can hear you without that alarm.
Sorry. So a few weeks ago, I had this series of three dreams, and I don't really know what to say about them. I tried to write about them, but there weren't any things in the dream. There weren't any people, or there was one shape that sort of keeps coming up that's like but not even a real complete shape, and it was whooshing and light changes, but I was present in the dream. And so when I, the first night, I tried to write the dream down, and I just sort of wrote down what I just said. And then the next night I had it again. And really, I don't think there was any difference. I can't say they were non-sensory, but they were kind of like outside of sensory. And then I had it again, and that same shape, it was kind of like an envelope, part of an envelope thing. And it was the most form that I saw, but I just don't know what to do with it. And then after the third one, it didn't happen anymore, but it does come to me in when I sit, you know, it sort of comes up again.
And so what, Quilly, definitely have some ideas. So can you say a little bit more about the felt quality? I mean, what is both the somatic quality and also the affective quality? I mean, what do you register on those domains?
It's certainly, it doesn't really have very much affective quality. It's not pleasant. It's neither pleasant nor.
Okay.
I didn't have any resistance to it. I was curious about it.
Okay. So the curiosity comes from the fact that these things are almost, again, I'm just going to throw out some words and let me put them in your mouth, but these are almost like protoplasmic, pre-imagistic dreams. In other words, there's no fully reified form. That, hence, you said there's, they aren't sensory, but yeah. There's still something appearing, but there isn't some kind of imagistic or something you can wrap your...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sound like, but not sound. I don't know.
So these are great. This is like stage 8, stage 9 dream yoga, because or lead towards that dimension, because before the dream actually crystallizes into any discernible articulated image, it's actually going to manifest as a preformed kind of energetic. And so what is actually being communicated is something that is actually a little bit more foundational to even the dream itself. So it's like a germinative stage coming out of complete formlessness, manifesting into the somewhat reified dimension of the articulate dream itself. So there's this kind of intermediate bandwidth of this kind of protoplasm of awareness that's actually taking place before the dream crystallizes into something that's more familiar, recognizable, and you can almost, in your own language, in sensory. And so what I would do is just perhaps explore it as such. And maybe, I mean, what can you actually do with it? I mean, one is just simply become more familiar with it, you know, just simply witness it, become more familiar with it. And then if you can develop the capacity to actually somehow stay with it and then see what happens when it dissolves, for instance, right? Where does it take you when it dissolves? I might recommend that as an instruction, because it will then take you back into that from which it arises, you know, Turiya. So you'll be able to follow that back into the formless dimension from which it arose. So these are very interesting states of mind. They're energetic qualities, somewhat connected again with Sambhogakaya, these kind of energetic preformed dimensions that you can really learn about what takes place behind the curtain before even at the images at the level of a dream start to crystallize into the dream itself. So
I did at one point just remember to let go, like just allow it. And it was like a holding of it or you know, but it didn't fit. But my relationship to it,
What was your relationship to it prior to that?
Well, exactly. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, once in a retreat, I can remember this thought soup. It was like I could see that there could be thoughts, but there weren't. And, you know, but there was a lot of activity. And it was similar, but not really. But not the same. My relationship to it was maybe there was some contraction because it was so unfamiliar. And that's what I meant when I let go. So it just, but I didn't fear it. It was just unusual. It was a startle or something.
Yeah, exactly. So that's pretty much what I was intuiting. And so again, always as a default, if you can kind of step back, witness, let go, and just let it play out, that will probably be the greatest insight. And so when you have the sense of contraction and references, honestly, part of it is because you are in fact trying to understand it. And that's great, but I wouldn't try to understand it when you're having it. I would try to understand it like post-experience, right? Don't try to understand it when you're having the experience. Let the experience unfold. It'll be clear enough. It'll be registered in your memory. Then you come out of the experience, then you can try to understand it. Because if you try to
trying to understand it, you know, I mean, that is, it seems like that's what I'm trying to do, but it gets into the head instead of.
Wait, exactly. So don't do it when you're having the experience. Just let the experience allow itself. Let it do whatever it's going to do. Get out of the way. It will do whatever it's going to do. And then you can discuss it in situations like this. You can work with it. You can retrospectively come back and then try to understand it. Don't try to understand it when you're having it. Okay?
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
So great to see you.
Yes, thank you. It's so good to see you.
Take care, dear. Okay. Keenan, fire away, bud.
Hi, Andrew. Good to see you. Sorry. Okay, so earlier you were talking about how in Buddhism there is a difference from Advaita Vedanta of consciousness, like a higher level. And I just wanted to kind of check in with you because I'm just these days I've been exploring this concept, which is in Kashmir Shaivism and Indian philosophy called Parama Shiva, which is beyond Shiva and Shakti or consciousness or and awareness of being conscious, I suppose. So yeah, I was just wondering if you would suggest some exploration or any
Yeah,
points.
you might listen to the conversation I had on Edge of Mind with Swami Sarvapriyananda, because we get into this a little bit. And basically it really is principally a semantic issue, so I wouldn't get too tongue-tied in with this. It's just the Buddhists are a little bit more fussy with the granularity about using this word consciousness. And so I asked Swami, because we're talking about emptiness. And I asked him, I said, in your languaging is from Advaita Vedanta, can you associate pure consciousness with emptiness? And he said, yes. And so again, in Buddhist languaging, pure consciousness is an oxymoron. There's no such thing. And I actually like the way they centrifuge that out. I like the granularity, because when people get into this whole consciousness thing, it can get a little fuzzy. And so what we're trying to do with the languaging, with all these things, is we're fundamentally trying to bring a level of clarity and articulation, which our languaging can represent, to to a domain that's otherwise really fuzzy and woolly and inarticulate, like mind, consciousness, awareness, like what are you really talking about? Well, the Buddhists get super interested in this and they debate it and they have incredible systems of articulation. I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that granularity. So it's not in any way an overt criticism of Kashmir Shaivism. I'm a huge student of that. In fact, I'm just devouring the Spanda Karikas right now. The whole Spanda doctrine is blowing me away. It's just that the Buddhist languaging around this just has this particular differentiation, which I resonate
Yeah,
with.
absolutely. Thank you. And my concern is more for my own understanding.
Yeah, well, if there's something anywhere else you want to go with this, fire away.
I guess the only thing that comes to mind is I was recently reading some quotes by Nisargadatta Maharaj, and he repeatedly, one of the things that I find different in his works is that he repeatedly says that the sense of I amness is itself a spontaneously emerging phenomena for something that's even beyond it, which is different than what you would not hear from other Advaitic scholars as per my reading. So I was just curious if you had to describe it, if it was possible as a pointer, what would this place be?
You can't describe it. That's the key. It's ineffable. It's beyond language. I mean, the better thing to do would be to dance it, to write a poem, or express it in a painting. I mean, the minute you reify it into any language, any instantiation of language, you're screwed. What did Korzybski say? Whatever you say it is, it isn't. And so really the best ways, as you know, the via negativa, the apophatic way, you actually, the most accurate descriptions are articulations of what it is not. The minute you start to assert it from Buddhist languaging, this is the colossally important difference between Prasangika Majjhimagga and Shenthong Majjhimagga, where you're no longer trying to affirm anything. You're just basically negating, non-affirming negation. So I can understand Nisargadatta and also Rupert Spira and many other really beautiful, wonderful, elegant people talking about the I am quality. But the Buddhists would just shred that notion. I mean, they would just decimate it. But what Rupert says that I really like on a provisional level, if you really understand the limitations of when you say I and am, because even those two have to really be taken apart, he says the quality of I am is what we label to this notion of our understanding of this mind at large. And so if you just define everything and you put quotation mark around everything and you qualify the beans out of everything, you can say certain things. But what did Rumi say? Silence is the language of God. Silence is the language of reality. All else is poor translation. So that's why we meditate. That's why we go beyond hearing and even contemplating into meditating, the third of the three pedagogical approaches for full digestion, metabolism, and incorporation, where the fundamental gnosis comes from direct experiential, what do they call it? You'll get direct valid cognition, completely beyond concept, completely beyond gate, beyond everything. That's when you know. And then when you come out, then you struggle as a poet, as an artist, as a writer, and you drive yourself nuts trying to put this, trying to shrink wrap infinity into these phonemes, into these language bits. It just doesn't work, man. So you, I think you understand that. So, yeah, I'm not sure where else to run with this.
Yeah, just one last thing. I might be saying something totally wrong. Please correct me if I am. So I've had like a kind of like meditative experiences where the sense, like a thought appears, but there is no sense of its ownership.
Oh, that's nice.
And beautiful. This is coming from memory now. So
yeah, it usually does come from memory. It won't actually come when you're having the experience, right?
Right.
it comes postscript, just like with Quilly's question. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wanted to kind of connect it with like somewhat of a regular experience, which is oftentimes you're not aware, you're driving a car or doing an activity, and then that awareness comes in. And of course it can be, at one level, I would say I'm distracted, but sometimes there's not that feeling of distraction. I'm wondering if that, any thought that appears in this space, when you become aware, would that might be the same space that we're referring to?
Yes, absolutely, positively. And therefore, thoughts are never the problem. This is the point here. Thoughts are never the problem. Thoughts are just the spontaneous radiance, the lila, the rolpa, the play of the mind. Thoughts are just the play. And so when you have this experience, which is quite beautiful, this non-referential, it's a lucid thought. This is a lucid thought experience. It's a non-referential, non-dual relationship to thought. The thought arises of itself, thoughts without a thinker. You had the experience, but there's no thinker there. That's really beautiful. I mean, that's when the mind is so infused with space that whatever arises, arises reflexively aware. There is no thinker. There is just the display, the shine, the spark, the radiance of the thought itself. And what you probably notice retrospectively is when you have a thought like that, what does it do? It self-liberates. It doesn't give birth to another thought. Linking thinking. So you're talking about non-dualistic thinking. There is non-dualistic thinking. That's a non-dualistic thought. That's what it is. And in the mind of the Buddha, that's the way these thoughts play out. They arise, completely self-liberate, like a campfire spark dissolving into the nighttime sky. They leave no trace. They don't link up. And they just, it's just a play of the mind driven by the inner winds. And so that's a beautiful experience. Well said. And to whatever extent, cultivate that. Just nurture that. So how that ties into the car driving thing, that's a different thing. I think that's probably more just spacing out, but I can't say for sure.
I guess I was checking that I find myself more relaxed with this before earlier when this kind of experience I have is I was like, oh, I was mindless and, you know, I have to become mindful. And now I find myself often becoming relaxed that it's not a problem.
Let me interrupt that right here.
Okay.
That's really important because that's the near enemy of this experience.
Okay.
That's the near enemy. And that's why I was thinking about the driving thing, because I don't think that was it. That's the near enemy of this, where in fact you are spacing out. The thoughts are rising. There's a momentary sense that you're not there. You are there. It's just behind a little fog bank. So that's the near enemy of this. And it's extremely subtle, but there is definitely a difference, because otherwise what you're doing is you're just kind of gapping out in a pejorative way, instead of just allowing that to arise reflexively aware, and then instantly, spontaneously self-liberates. So there, that's a colossal near enemy of what you're talking about.
That makes sense, because the former kind of experience that I was referring to had a profound sense of reality and a perfume that stays after that. Whereas this one, there really wasn't that perfume.
High five. That's it. Yeah. Love okay. it, man. I love your stuff. Good stuff. Nice to see you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so we can do Glenn, and then we're getting close to finishing up. So, hey, Glenn.
Hi, I'm in San Francisco, and we have Navy jets flying all over. So if it gets really loud, I'm sorry, I can't do anything about that.
Okay. We're good. I said, so, we're good so far, so go ahead, fire away.
Okay, well, they just stopped. So I have 1.5 questions that come from your recent interviews. Okay. In the second Bernardo Kastrup interview, when he says that it is, he thinks, near impossible to come to and know Buddha nature, you let him go.
I didn't I absolutely let him go. There are a couple of things. I love this guy to death, and I think he's an unbelievable thinker. But this is a tricky thing with my guests, right? I have to be extremely politic to not just like call him out on all these sorts of things. I wanted Bernardo to run with it, which he did, and I thought it was brilliant. But there were a couple of things he said that I definitely did not agree with. And it just didn't feel appropriate at the time to say, hey, wait a minute, Bernardo, let's take this puppy apart. I felt if I did that, I would have interrupted the stream that he was on. But retrospectively, I'm glad you caught that. It was like, boy, I wrote the note down and I said, you know, do I stop him right now? And I said, so yeah, there are a couple of things he said that again, the other one would be the beneficent nature of reality. Remember when he talked about that? He said, he goes, I don't think that's the way it is. Remember, he gave the whole example of the lion being eaten or the elephant being eaten. I mean, I thought that was also a little bit different from my understanding. But anyway, I cut you off.
Yeah.
There are a couple of things he said there that didn't quite fully land with me. So.
Well, that's interesting. And I contrast it with the end of the second Christopher Bache interview, where if I understand the terminology right, Christopher is talking about getting to the point where he realizes that there's an evolutionary consciousness developing. And you really take him to task for that. And I noticed you didn't do that with Bernardo. So
right. Well, part of the reason was I had two separate sessions with Chris. And it's always a little bit, this is part of the dance. I'm not trained as a podcaster. I'm a nerd. I'm an intellectual that reads stupid books and then talks to people. And so I'm learning, this is an on-the-job training for me, you know, with this podcast stuff. I'm not a podcaster. So with Chris, I just felt with him, especially since this was my second, like close to 5 hours with the guy, I just felt I could politely call him a little bit and say, this is not what the traditions say. This is not my understanding. And he was okay with like dancing with that. And so sometimes I just make these calls spontaneously with my guests, and with Bernardo, to me at the time, it just didn't feel quite right for me to come in there and say, hey, wait a second. So it's just, you know, what do you do, right? That's just what I did.
Well, Christopher has a guru, right? Or maybe he has.
He's a Vajrayana practitioner. He studies a little bit with Tulsimar Alioni. I don't know if she's his main teacher. I don't know. I mean, he's a tantric practitioner, but I don't know his lineage or what he is. And so that's another reason I felt I could go a little bit farther. You know, we have a little bit more connection. Bernardo is a brilliant, brilliant guy, but he doesn't really roll that much in the meditative, contemplative, spiritual world. He does mostly with his connection with Rupert, but he's a scientist. He's an intellect. He's a scholar. And so therefore there are tremendous areas of confluence, resonance, but there are also areas where, hey, you know, this doesn't relate to the world as I've come to understand it. And it's always a little bit tricky to, again, get in there and you know, I mean, if I had the ground rules where I said in advance, hey, are you okay with a little Dharma combat? Then I'm more, you know, I'm more willing to kind of get in there a little bit with some of these people. But I also want to be just a gracious host and let it go. But I'm glad you caught that because there are a couple things there as well.
Well, there are both. Really enjoyable podcast. So thank you.
Yeah. So is that both the 1.5
questions? Oh, that's it. Yeah, that was that. Yeah.
Okay. Nice to see you, Glenn. All right, one last thing here from Tim on the chat column, and then we'll close it up for today. Do you think our karmic debt with another person can be mitigated, balanced out, or at least greatly lessened through dream yoga? Or can we only do that with the interaction on the physical plane? For sure. Absolutely, positively, Tim. And so many teachers say this. Alan Wallace, the classic teachers, will all tell you, you absolutely positively can purify your karma in dream yoga. One example here, the first Karmapa Chusam Kempa in the year 1041, started the whole Tuku lineage thing, attained his enlightenment. And he said dream yoga is what did it for him. So in order to attain enlightenment, you got to clean up your karmic act. So he cleaned up all his karma. Again, to whatever extent, I don't really know, through the practice of dream yoga. So absolutely positively, that's why you do the practices. Okay. So, hey, anyway, we're done for today. Thanks, everybody. Sorry if I get a little speedy here, but I want to get through just a ton of questions in a short period of time. So I end up talking a little bit faster than I'd like. But at the end, what we do is we dedicate all the merit. It's a big part of what we talk about in the Pure Land teachings, by the way, because merit is what creates the Pure Lands. But anything that we've done of value, we send out to all the people in Ukraine, all the people that are suffering, all the sentient beings on this planet. Always remember that what we're doing, it's not just for ourselves, it's really for others, it's for helping the world. So always maintain this larger framework. And then if you want to do it, you can turn on your camera, you can turn, release your mute button. We can all say this very geeky goodbye. Great to see everybody. See you.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.